Hello, and welcome to the Archives of Diseases of Childhood's Archimedes podcast. In this podcast, we talk about critical appraisal and evidence-based medicine as it comes to child health. So that's the system that underpins the way of working. That's finding a clinical question, something that you're not really sure about, collapsing it into something really focused that the medical literature might help you with, and often splitting that into the areas of patient's problem, the P, the intervention you're thinking about against the other one, the standard one, the comparator, and the outcomes that you wish to be improved or the side effects that you wish to look out for in particular. And you get this PICO question. This then goes away to search the electronic databases, usually to try and find the best quality answers to these problems. And then from there, we weigh it for its strengths and weaknesses and come up with a bottom line. What do you do with this information when it comes to being clinical? Well, that's a sort of very abbreviated version of what the whole of evidence-based practice is. This episode, we're going to think a little bit about some aspect of that that you might not have thought too hard about before, and also think about our clinical question. Now, our clinical question this month comes from Joanne Stock and Sanjeev Dispand at the Princess Royal Hospital in Shrewsbury in the UK. This one is asking the question about breech babies who flipped round inside by some clever obstetrician doing external cephalic version. Are they still, when they've popped out, at increased risk of developmental dysplasia of the hip, just like babies that are born in a full breech position? The case that set this off is a 36-hour-old neonate who is being looked at for that early examination. They were breech up to 36 weeks and then flipped over and came out head first. Their question set them off via PubMed and Embase to try and get hold of what was going to help them in answering it. They looked at quite a few and came with three studies that were relevant. Now, in this setting, you don't want to be looking for clinical trials. Nobody wants to randomise a baby to get screened or not in this setting. We're looking for cohort studies, groups of kids taken forward in time to look at a particular outcome, often after a particular sort of exposure. What they had here were large cohort studies. There is one with 6,571 births, with 257 of them breech and 137 of them flipped round. There's another one with 35 successfully flipped and 87 unsuccessfully flipped, and another one with 510 flipped breeches that came around and popped out head first over the period of only 3 years or so. These are all followed forwards to look to see whether there were problems of the dislocatable hip, the developmental dysplasia of the hip. What was found when compared to the babies that had always apparently been head first is that the rates were higher. So cephalic babies, around about 1% of them having the developmental dysplasia on the hip, the breech and the breech but turned round babies up somewhere at the 4% or so. It might be that in some of the other studies, it looks like if they manage to switch round and come out head first, the rate of hip dysplasia might be a little bit lower in those who went successful ECV, that sort of flipping round procedure, but the rates are really not massively different. Now, this is probably to do with the fact that actually, if they're breech at that point, their hips have been in that position for so long that that is where the DDH is there. There's some suggestion from some of the data that if you breech in a longer period of time, sort of beyond that sort of 26-week period, over the 30-week period, your rate is higher than the other way around. But putting all of this together, it really does mean that that rate, even if your flip drone is a little bit lower, probably is higher than your cephalic babies and falls into that category that they should be referred for routine ultrasound hip at that point of delivery. Now, some of you will know that in the UK, that is current national guidance. This is good strength to keep going with that guidance. And if you're not working in the UK, then maybe it's time to look at your local or your group policies in order that you can flick something like that into action if you have the resources. Now, having thought all about that and where they went off and they pulled all that information together, they didn't search into the murky areas that sometimes a full-on systematic reviewer will go. The grey literature. When you think about grey, you think about grey days, grey food, grey water. Moving to grey is usually miserableness, boredom, potentially even disease. Grey was the centre point of satire of a UK Prime Minister in the last millennium. Systematic reviewers, though, a different beast of human. They can absolutely love a bit of grey. And now I've said that out loud, that sounds slightly dodgier than it did when it was written down. Anyway, cracking on. The grey literature is a term used to describe the stuff that is a bit in the shadows. It's reports and studies that are not entirely unpublished. The ones that are entirely unpublished are referred to as the file drawer problem, because in the olden days we used to have file drawers that we put files in and papers with. Anyway, go to a history class. But these grey elements have not been given the shiny badge that goes with presentation in an academic journal or being chatted about at a conference. The grey papers might actually be the very detailed reports or the technical papers that sit behind a charitable organisation or a government department. They may be theses that have been submitted for research degrees that have actually then been awarded and so potentially gone through more scrutiny than some of the papers that you read in some other journals, not ours. Or there could be papers that are in preprint. They're optimistically phrased for some of the articles like this. Or they could be clinical study reports. Those are those massive tomes that talk about everything that went on in a study rather than the cut down version of the journal article. They don't have the same sort of peer review. But to be fair, peer review doesn't make a massive difference to actual clinical quality of the study, but it probably does change how it gets reported and the discussion around it. Now, the value of grey literature in the presence of systematic review is behind this sort of concept that systematic review tries to catch everything in the world and bring it into view so that we get a true idea of what's going on rather than a biased one. It is partly a way of capturing things like anti-publication bias. So we're working against the idea that some things don't get published. And if you call it publication bias, I accept that that sounds like it is the editor's fault that things don't get published and are trying to make the literature only look in one way. But actually, there's a whole load of publication bias that starts with the authors not submitting it in the first place. Using that grey literature, it grows and it deepens the pool of information that you can synthesise. And while sometimes this makes no difference whatsoever, and sometimes the quality of that stuff is so poor that it shouldn't make the difference, it does sometimes make a difference, and it should be there looked at in a really high quality systematic review to say, is this going to make us understand the whole area very, very differently? So, whilst grey can be pretty dull, not everything in the grey is uninteresting or unimportant. Now, if you want to put your article forwards, go to the website, look on the instructions to authors, follow those instructions, follow the template, send your stuff in, and we hopefully have a relatively supportive and helpful editorial process to really give you the best chance for your clinical question, your Archimedes, to get published in due course. But if you just want to be on the receiving end of it, crack on, read them, listen to the podcast, tell your granny about us, and everybody in the world will be that little bit happier. So until next month, thank you very much for listening, and we will speak to you soon.